important things to do than steer a boat. Where is it? He closed his eyes and turned off the music. The feed from the spike into the island's security system was still open. He could hear the security commander talking to the rescue boat, which was just now setting out from the far side of the island. No one had noticed the data tap yet, but that would shortly become academic anyway. The security forces would reach the downed helicopter in only a few minutes. Unless it was very badly damaged, they would quickly recognize that it had been wired for remote operation. They would know they had been suckered. Where? He let himself fall backward into his own thoughts, searching for the elusive first grasp, for that pulse, that electronic heartbeat that would show him where to grip. He had discovered his ability to twist, as he thought of it, in his first foster home. Actually, the twist was really the second miracle. The first was that he had been fostered out at all. At 7 years of age, he had already killed 3 people, all of them children about his own age. Only one of the murders had been acknowledged, although ascribed to a tragic but momentary loss of self-control. The other 2 deaths had been blamed on an accident. This was all nonsense, of course. On both occasions, Dredd, who had not yet chosen that melodramatic name, had carried a hammer in the waistband of his pants for days, waiting, pushing the pair of victims in the second attack down an iron stairwell after beating in their heads, had been a last bit of anger, rather than a precocious attempt to disguise his work. Even without death in his background, the Queensland Juvenile Authority would not have found it easy to place the child. Just the fact of his parentage, his alcoholic prostitute mother, an Aborigine, his father, a Filipino pirate, who would be captured and summarily executed not long after the transaction that resulted in baby Dredd, ensured that the authority had to offer prospective foster parents cash on the side, a rebate, as it were. But moving young Johnny Woolgaroo, the agency bureaucrats had quickly decided, was worth juggling the budget. Johnny was a disaster waiting to happen. The moments leading up to the first time he twisted something had been surprisingly ordinary. His foster mother, infuriated by his cruel treatment of the family cat, had called him a little black bastard. He had knocked something off a table and she had grabbed him, intent on locking him in his room. As she dragged him across the living room, he had reached a crescendo of screaming anger, and the wall screen had abruptly wavered and gone blank. Much to his guardian's unhappiness, the damage to the internal electronics proved irreparable, and they had gone almost a month without a link to the normal world until they could afford to replace it. They had not connected the occurrence with their ward, although they knew him to be capable of other, far more prosaic acts of destruction. But Johnny had noted it himself, and wondered if it might be magic. A few experiments had proved that it was, or just as good as magic anyway, and it was apparently his alone. A single day in his dark room with his stepfather's pad had taught him that he could do it even without being angry, if he just thought the right things in the right way. He had not used the ability for much of anything, minor vandalism, spiteful reprisals, for several years, and through several more foster homes. Even as his secrets grew deeper and more terrible, he never thought of using his ability to twist things for anything grander than blanking security cameras at the site of one of his robberies, or one of his chases, for those had begun even before he reached sexual maturity. It was not until the old man, at massive expense, had maneuvered him out of young offender's prison, and then into a succession of mental institutions, the last one of which the old man more or less owned, that Dredd understood he could use the twist for bigger things. The boat bounced, and for a moment he was jolted back into the real world. Dredd pushed away the sky, the water, the men crouched silently beside him. Where is it? Get it back. Hold it now. But this kind of use was much harder than the simple destruction he had practiced in the earliest days, or the later tactic of simply freezing electronic components. Tonight's sort of trick required skills he still had not completely mastered, despite almost a year spent in one of the old man's labs, going through exercise after exhausting exercise, while white-coated scientists offered cheerful encouragement, a supportiveness belied by the fear of him they could never quite hide. It would have been hard to say which growing power he had enjoyed more. Find it, then reach. He grasped the data tap at last, seized it with his mind. letting his thoughts slide around it and into it as he took its measure. The mechanical intrusion into the island's electronic nerve system accomplished by his gear team had been a crucial first step. He needed to be as far into the security system as possible before beginning his own work. Already the fine control required was making his head ache. When he used his ability for more than a few moments, he thought he could feel the twist itself glowing hot and sore in his brain like an inflamed gland. Like a hunting hound nosing for a scent, he searched through the inexplicable inner darkness of the twist until he found just the kind of electronic surges he needed, then followed their path backward, tracking the data stream to its source in the security system's main processors and memory. Processors were only electronic artifacts, not really that much different than simpler things like surveillance cameras or car ignitions, just electrical impulses controlling mechanical artifacts. Dredd knew it would be easy to twist them hard, to give them a jolt so strong that the system would shut down, but if that had been all he wanted, he would have let that jackass Celestino have his data bomb. He needed to wade through his own pain to achieve something far more subtle, more useful. He needed to find the system's soul and make it his. The system was complex, but its structural logic was no different than any other. He found the desired set of electronic gates and gave them each a little push. They resisted, but even the resistance told him something. He had lost everything but the data stream now. Even the meaningless noises on the security radio and from the night and waves that surrounded his physical body were gone. He pushed the gates again, only one at a time now, doing his best to gauge the effect of each change before he made it. He worked delicately, even though his head was throbbing so hard he felt like screaming. The last thing he wanted to do was crash the system. At last, in a blackness shot with blood-red migrainous lightning, he found the right sequence. As the metaphorical door swung wide, a dark joy swelled inside him, almost stronger than the pain. He had constructed an indescribable something out of his own will, a skeleton key to open an invisible, unreachable lock. And now the Isla del Santuario's entire system was opening to him like a 10-credit whore, ready to surrender its secrets. Exhausted, Dredd struggled back toward the other world, the world outside the twist.
"Track 3," he said hoarsely. "I'm into the motherlode. Hook it up and sort it."
Celestino grunted a nervous affirmative and began making order of the streams of raw data. Dredd opened his eyes, leaned over the railing, and vomited. The boat was only a half kilometer off the island when he could think coherently again. He closed his eyes. The sight of the data windows superimposed on the choppy waters was making him feel sick again, and inspected the results of his infiltration, the naked workings of Santuario's infrastructure. The security machinery's various scanners and checkpoints lured him for a moment, but after the obsessive way he had mapped out what to turn off and when in the planning stages of the action, he doubted even Celestino could mess it up. He also glanced at the standard programs which regulated the estate's physical being, but none of that was important at the moment. There was only one thing out of the ordinary, but that was exactly what he was looking for. Some two, actually, judging by the paired input sites, was hooked up to a LEOS, a low-orbit communication satellite, and a huge amount of data was moving through it both ways.
"Our target is on the net, I guess. But what the hell is he doing there that he has to move so many gigs?"
Dredd pondered for a moment. He had everything he needed already. Still, it didn't seem like a good idea to let such high-intensity usage go unexamined. Besides, if this busy little bee really was the target, maybe Dredd would get some kind of idea about why the old man wanted Sky God dead. A little information never went amiss.
"Track 3. Spike me into one of those hot spots there. I think it's the target's lab. If what he's receiving is VR, don't give me the full wraparound. Just a POV window and audio."
"Certainly, Hefe."
Dredd waited for a long moment. Then another window opened up against the blackness of his inner eyelids. In it, a table lined with faces that looked vaguely Indian stretched before him. There was a monkey sitting on the tabletop halfway down, and the target's gaze kept flicking to it. Dredd felt an almost childlike glee. He was sitting unnoticed on his prey's shoulder like an invisible demon, like death itself.
Most of these activities were being controlled by a single group of people,
someone was saying next to him. The quiet, earnest voice was not his target's. One of El Patron's academic friends, perhaps. A group of self-satisfied scientists having a little virtual symposium of some kind. He contemplated tuning out, but the next words jumped out at him as though they had been screamed.
These people, wealthy and powerful men and women, were a consortium that called themselves the Grail Brotherhood.
Dredd watched and listened with rapidly increasing interest.
Track three, he said after a few moments. Keep this open. Are we recording this?
Just what you were seeing, Hefei. I can try to copy everything going in and out, but I don't think we have that much memory. Not to mention bandwidth.
Dredd opened his eyes. The boat was almost within range of the perimeter lights. There were other things to worry about now. He could pick up most of the details once they had secured the target.
Don't worry about it, then. But there are a lot of other people at that gathering. Find out if they're Sims, and if so, where they're coming in from. But first, be ready to initiate defenses shut down on my order.
He checked on Track 2, who were waiting about the same distance off the island on the southeastern side. The reports coming in over the island's security band told him that the rescue team was just about to discover the helicopter trick.
Track 3. Shut down.
The perimeter lights winked out. There was a squall of indignant protest over the security band, but with the shutdown sequence now begun, none of the radio locations were talking to anyone but themselves. And Dredd.
Track 2, here we go.
He signaled to the pilot of his own boat, who gunned the engine and sent them skidding across the bumpy surf toward the beach. As they hit the shallows, his men were already rolling over the side, the first to land sweeping the beach and house walls with ELF weapons. Those of the island's guards not wearing counter-frequency gear dropped, shaken into jelly, without ever knowing what had hit them. As he followed his men onto the sand, Dredd turned off all but the necessary pictures, but he kept the voices from the target's virtual conference going in his head. Already, an idea was beginning to form. The island was so dark that Dredd did not even bother to crawl up from the beach. Three more sentries in anti-ELF suits appeared on the catwalk outside the nearest guardhouse, one of them holding a high-powered flashlight, probably on his way to find out what had happened to the island's generators. Dredd gestured. The silenced troners sounded like a stick being dragged along a picket fence as the sentries fell. The flashlight bounced from the catwalk and blinked end over end down to the beach. Resistance was stiff at the front portico of the main house, but Dredd was not in such a hurry now. His target was still locked into his simulation, and since Celestino had remotely sealed the door locks and thrown a data blanket over the target to prevent incoming calls from security, Sky God had no idea that his castle had been stormed. If nothing else, Dredd admired Otosko's new security service for honoring their contract. They were fighting fiercely. The half-dozen pouring fire out of the hardened guardhouse beside the front door seemed capable of holding off an army far larger than Dredd's. However, good security work required more than bravery. Foresight was important, too. One of the assault team managed to jam an incendiary grenade through a gunport, although he sustained a fatal wound in the process. When it exploded a moment later, the heat was so fierce that even the steel-plex windows softened and bulged outward. The Track 2 team, which had come in through the back of the complex to attack the main security office, was going to be a little while getting free. But Dredd was quite satisfied. Out of 2 15-man assault teams, he had only 3 units down that he knew of, and only one of those 3 killed, with the action 75% done. Against the kind of security package a rich bastard like Otosko could afford, that was more than acceptable. As his 2 bangmen wired hemispheres of Anvax hammer gel to the massive front door, he allowed himself a few moments with his unsuspecting target.
Brotherhood has built the most powerful, sophisticated simulation network imaginable.
It was the calm, high voice again, coming from someone standing near Otosko.
At the same time, they have manipulated and injured the minds of thousands of children, I still have no idea why. In fact, I summoned you here, all of you, in hopes that together we might discover some answers.
Dredd was getting more and more intrigued. If Otasco wasn't leading this little conspiracy, who was? Did the old man know things had gone so far? The explosive gel was triggered. A flash of fire briefly illuminated the bodies scattered on the porch as the main door sagged and fell inward. Dredd turned off the window, feeding him the target's visuals. The audio channel was briefly usurped by an announcement of Track 2's successful conquest of the security office.
"This is it, gentlemen," he said cheerfully. "We forgot our invitations, so we'll just have to let ourselves in."
Once through the scorched doorframe, he stopped for a moment to inspect the piles of rubble and powder that had been a collection of Mayan stonework, installed by sad chance too near the front door. He detailed most of his crew to look for stray security and to round up the household staff, then took a bang man and two commandos and headed for the basement lab. As the explosives man knelt in front of the lab door, Dredd tuned in again to what had become a confusing welter of voices.
"Track 3," he said. "In just about a minute, the target's line is going to be free. I want you to keep it open, whatever it takes, and to hold the rest of the guests in the simulation, if possible, while we figure out who they are. Is that clear?"
"Yes, I understand."
Celestino sounded tensely excited, which gave Dredd a brief moment of unease. But the Colombian was doing all right so far. It was the rare and exceptional person who didn't get at least a little worked up while participating in a large-scale armed criminal assault. Dredd and the others retreated back down the hallway. Then the bang man thumbed his transmitter. The walls trembled only a little as the hammer gel bent the heavy security door into a curl like stale bread. They kicked it aside and entered. The white-haired man, who had been reclining in a pillowy chair, had apparently felt the vibration of the controlled blast and was struggling to his feet. His wife, on the far side of the lab in her own chair, was still submerged in VR, twitching gently. Bolivar Otasco stumbled a little, still not completely separated from the simulation and its override on his exterior physical responses. He paused, swaying, and stared at Dredd as though he felt he should recognize him.
"You have just met the Angel of Death, and he's a stranger. He is always a stranger."
The line from some obscure interactive popped into Dredd's mind and made him grin. As Otasco opened his mouth to speak, Dredd flicked a finger, and the nearest commando shot the anthropologist between the eyes. Dredd stepped forward and pulled the jack out of Otasco's neurocannula, then gestured at the woman. The other soldier did not move toward her, but thumbed his troner to auto-fire and sprayed her down, blowing the cable out of her neck and sending her to the floor in a bloody heap. Mission accomplished. Dredd surveyed the two bodies briefly, then sent the two commandos upstairs to rejoin the others. He checked back in on the simulation in time to hear a new voice.
"Trying to leave would be a very bad idea."
It was an unfamiliar voice, processed through a translator. It took him several moments to realize it was Celestino's.
"I'm afraid the Otascos have left early,"
the gear man was saying through Otasco's usurped sim.
"But don't worry. We'll think of ways to keep the party entertaining."
"You shit!" Dredd screamed. "You bloody idiot! Get out of there!"
There was no response. Celestino was not listening to the command channel. Dredd felt rage expanding inside him like scalding steam.
"Dulce, are you there?"
"I am."
"Have you got a gun?"
Yes.
Her voice suggested she always carried one, but didn't use it.
"Go in and shoot that little bastard. Right now."
"Shoot
now! He may have just blown the most important part of this whole thing sky high. Do it! You know I'll take care of you."
Already high in Dredd's estimation, Dulcinea Anwin rose even higher. He did not hear another sound from her until after something had exploded loudly on the Track 3 audio channel.
"Now what?"
She was back on the line, breathing hard.
Christ, I've never done that before.
Then don't look at it. Go back to the other room. You can override from there. I want to know who's in that simulation. Find the outside lines. Most importantly, I want one of those lines. Just one. That we can spike.
She took a ragged breath, then steadied.
Got it.
While he waited, Dredd examined the Otosko's lab. Expensive stuff. In other circumstances, he wouldn't have minded taking some of it with him, although it would have been strictly against the old man's orders. But he smelled a bigger prize. He gestured to the bang man, who was standing in the hallway smoking a skinny black cigar.
Wire it up.
The man ground the cigar out on the floor, then began attaching nodules of Anvax gel to various points around the room. Once Dredd and Dulcie had emptied out the contents of Otosko's hard storage, he would trigger the explosives remotely. As he was making his way back up the stairs, Dulcie Anwin came back online.
I've got good news and bad news. Which first?
His grin was reflexive. Hunger, rather than humor.
I can take the bad news. There hasn't been much so far tonight.
Can't get a fix on most of these folks. There seem to be several different setups, but most of them are trace-proof. They're not puppets, I don't think, but they're using some kind of blind relay system. At least a couple of anonymous routers involved, plus some other even weirder stuff. If I had them all in one place for a couple of days, I might break something down, but otherwise, forget it.
They're already starting to scatter. They'll probably be offline in a few minutes. But you said most. Is that the good news?
I've got one of them in the crosshairs, guessed it in by the target. No relay, no weird runaround. Spike's already in place.
Dredd took a deep breath.
Great. That's perfect. I want you to do a quick trace, then pull up the user's index. Can you do that?
When do you want it?
Right now. I want you to use that spike to override and bump the user offline. Then you hold the sim yourself. Browse the index. Just quickly. We'll work up a better version later. And learn what you can. Whoever he or she is, that's who you are. Got it?
You want me to pretend to be this person? What about all the data work we have to do?
I'll do it myself. I need to do it myself. Don't worry. I'll get someone to relieve you in a little while. Hell, after I get the data squared away, I'll probably take that spike from you myself, too.
The pain in his head, the residue of the twist, was almost completely gone now. Dredd suddenly felt the need for music, and conjured up a swelling martial air. He had something the old man didn't, had it firmly in his jaws, and he was going to hang on to it until doomsday.
If any of the others at the conference, or whatever it is, stay in the simulation, you stay too. Keep your mouth shut. Record everything.
He was already busily making plans. As soon as he knew where this user lived, he would have him or her investigated and sanctioned, not necessarily in that order. He now had a front row seat. Christ, he exulted, a leading role in some mysterious conspiracy that had the old man scared to death. Also, the conspirators seemed to know a lot more about what the old man and his friends were up to than Dredd did himself. It was impossible to guess how valuable this little sleight of hand might turn out to be.
My time has come around at last.
He laughed. But he needed everything to be crystal clear, foolproof. Even the efficient Ms. Anwin could make a mistake in all this confusion.
Are you sure you got it?
He asked her.
You keep that sim working at all costs until I relieve you. You are that user. Don't worry about the overtime. I'll make it worth your while, Dulcie baby.
He laughed again. His early thoughts about Dulcinea as quarry had been superseded by a chase more glorious than anything he could have anticipated.
Get on it. I'll be back as soon as I finish up some loose ends here.
He strode up the stairs and into the huge entry hall. There was data to sift, and a lot of it. He would have to take care of that before following up on the sim. Monitor as much of it as he could before it went to the old man and his brotherhood. He suddenly very much wanted to know what Otosko had been doing. as well as what Atasco had known. It would mean another night without sleep, but it would surely be worth it. At the foot of the main staircase, a stone statue of a jaguar, blocky and expressionistic, crouched on a pedestal. He patted its snarling jaws for luck, then made a mental note to add Celestino's body to the cleanup squad's list of things to do. Chapter 38. A New Day. Netfeed News. Quiddipong, USA, demands more seats. Visual, U.S. Capitol Building, Washington. CM. VO. Quiddipong Electronics, USA, is threatening to filibuster the U.S. Senate unless it receives more representation. Visual, Quiddipong VPPR, Porfirio Vasquez Lowell, at press conference. Vasquez Lowell. The House of Representatives allots seats based on population, and the biggest states get the most House seats. The Senate is business-based. Quiddipong's gross worth has at least quintupled in the decade since the Industrial Senate Amendment was passed. So we deserve more seats. Simple. And we'd like to have a little chat with our colleagues in Britain's House of Enterprise, too. Things had gone from strange to stranger. Orlando, who had roused himself for a few moments to try to make the others understand, now could only sit staring as the room erupted into madness. Their hosts had vanished, the Atascos from their virtual bodies, Sellers completely. A woman across the table was screaming, a continuous wail of pain that was both heartbreaking and terrifying. Some of the sim-wearing guests sat like Orlando, in stunned silence. Others were shouting at each other like asylum inmates. Fredericks? He turned his throbbing head, looking for his friend. Another wave of the fever was crawling over him, and despite the amazing chaos, he was suddenly fighting the pull of sleep. Fredericks? Where are you? He hated the plaintive sound of his voice. His friend popped up from behind the table, hands over his ears. This whole thing impacts plus, Orlando. We have to get out of here. The shrieking stopped. But the excited babble continued. Orlando pulled himself upright. How? You told me we can't go offline. Besides, didn't you hear what that guy Sellers was saying? Fredericks shook his head emphatically. I heard, but I'm not listening. Come on! As he pulled at Orlando's arm, the room suddenly quieted. Over Fredericks' shoulder, Orlando saw Atasco moving again. I hope none of you think you're going anywhere. The sim was inhabited, but the voice was not Atasco's. Trying to leave would be a very bad idea. Oh, no. Oh, Jesus, moaned Fredericks. This is... we're... Something happened at the head of the table. Something swift and violent that Orlando couldn't quite make out, but Atasco's wife disappeared from his line of sight. I'm afraid the Atascos have left early, continued the new voice, sounding as pleased with its own evil as any cartoon villain. But don't worry. We'll think of ways to keep the party entertaining. For a long moment, nobody moved. A rustle of frightened murmurs ran through the guests as Atasco, or what had been Atasco, turned to survey them each in turn. Now, why don't you tell me your names, and if you cooperate... maybe I will be kind. The exotic woman Orlando had noted earlier, the tall, hawk-nosed one that he thought of as Nefertiti, shouted, You go to hell! Through a haze of fever, Orlando admired her spirit. With just a little effort, he could almost imagine this as a particularly complicated and inventive game. If so, Nefertiti was clearly the warrior princess. She even had a sidekick, if the talking monkey was with her. And me? Is there a category for dying hero? Fredericks was clutching the arm of Orlando's sim so tightly that he could actually feel pain even through sickness and machinery. He tried again to shake off his friend's grip. It was time to stand up. It was time to die on his feet in the final battle. Thargor would have wanted to go that way, even if he was only an imaginary character. Orlando rose, trembling. The false Atasco's eyes flicked toward him. Then suddenly the feather-crowned head snapped forward as if struck a blow by an invisible club. The God-King body froze again, then toppled swiftly to the floor. The terrified babble of the guests rose once more. Orlando took a few light-headed, staggering steps, then righted himself and headed across the room toward Nefertiti and her monkey friend. He had to push past the black-clad clown who called himself Sweet William, who was arguing with the shiny robot warrior Sim. Sweet William shot Orlando a scornful look as they bumped shoulders. That idiot would love the Palace of Shadows, Orlando thought. Hell, they'd probably make him the Pope. As he reached Nefertiti, Fredericks caught up with him, clearly unwilling to be left on his own in the middle of this madness. The dark-skinned woman was crouching beside the woman who had been screaming, holding her hand and trying to soothe her. "Do you have any idea what's going on here?" Orlando asked. Nefertiti shook her head. "But something has obviously gone wrong. I think we must find a way out." He wasn't sure, but he thought her accent sounded African or Caribbean.
"Finally, somebody who makes sense!" Frederick said angrily. "I've been..."
He was interrupted by a shout of surprise. All turned to the front of the room, where the white specter of Sellers Sim had reappeared. It raised its formless hands in the air, and the people nearest it drew back in fear.
"Please, listen to me."
To Orlando's relief, it sounded very much like Sellers.
"Please, we do not have much time."
The Sims crowded forward, already calling out questions. Nefertiti banged her fists on the table and shouted for silence. A couple of others joined her, including Sweet William, Orlando was surprised to see. After a few moments, the room quieted.
"I do not know how, but we seem to have been discovered."
Sellers was laboring to sound calm, and just barely succeeding.
"The island, the Otosko's real world estate, is under attack. Our hosts are both dead."
The robot-wearer cursed in floridly fluent Goggle Boy. Someone else shouted out in surprise and fear. Orlando could feel hysteria rising around him. If he had felt like his normal Thargor self, it would be time to start slapping some quiet common sense into some of these ninnies. But not only didn't he feel like Thargor, he was pretty terrified himself. Sellers was riding the panic, holding it down.
"Please, remember, the attack is happening in Cartagena, Colombia, in the real world, not here. You are in no immediate danger, but we cannot be found out, or the danger will be very, very real. I will assume that this attack is the work of the Grail Brotherhood, and that they know what they are looking for. If so, we only have minutes before they will be upon us.
So what should we do?"
It was the monkey, his lilting voice calmer than anyone else's.
"We have barely begun to speak of Otherland."
"Otherland? What the hell are you babbling about?"
shouted the woman who had earlier railed at Otosko.
"We have to get out of here. How do we go offline?"
She scrabbled at her neck as though attacked by invisible insects, but plainly could not find her neurocannula. There was another eruption. Clearly no one else could leave the simulation either.
"Silence!"
Sellers raised his hands.
"We have moments only. If your identities are to be protected, I must do my work. I cannot stay here, and neither can you. Temilun will not be a sanctuary. The Brotherhood will tear it to pieces. You must get out and into Otherland. I will work to keep you hidden until you can find a way to escape the network entirely."
"But how will we even get out of this place?"
Nefertiti, like her four-legged familiar, was doing a good job of controlling her emotions. But Orlando could hear the crack threatening to widen.
"This Temilun is as big as a small country. Are we going to run to the border? And how do you go from one simulation to another here, anyway?"
"The river is the boundary,"
Sellers said.
"But it is also a route from one simulation to the next."
He paused for a moment, thinking, then bent to Otosko's sim where it lay on the flagstones. He came up a moment later with something in his hand.
"Take this. It's Otosko's signet ring. There is a royal barge, I think, down at the port."
"I've seen it," Orlando called out. "It's big."
"Remember, Otosko is the god-king here, the master. If you command it with his ring, they will take you onto the river."
Sellers handed the ring to Nefertiti. Orlando felt another wave of stifling, muzzy warmth roll through his body. His eyes sagged halfway closed.
"Just sail on the river?"
Sweet William demanded.
"What is this? Huckleberry friggin' Finn? Where are we going? You got us into this, you bloody little man. How are you going to get us out of it?"
Sellers held out his hands, seeming to offer a benediction more than to plead for silence.
"There is no more time for talk. Already our enemies are trying to breach the defenses I have thrown together. There is still much I need to tell you. I will do my best to find you again."
"Find us?"
Fredericks took a step forward.
"You're not going to know where we are?"
"There is no time."
For the first time, Sellers' voice rose to a shout.
"I must go. I must go."
Orlando forced himself to speak. "Is there anything we can do to stop these people? Or at least find out what they're doing? We can't have a quest without something to quest for."
"I was not prepared for this."
Sellers took a ragged breath. His shapeless form seemed to sag.
"There is a man named Jonas. He was a prisoner of the Grail Brotherhood. His mind held captive in a simulation. I was able to reach him when he dreamed. I helped him to escape. Look for him."
"We supposed to sniff for some Cy-Yi Lo net knocker?"
The battle robot waved its arms, flashing the razor-sharp blades at its joints.
"While someone try to six us? You far, far crash!"
"I can't believe I have something in common with Bang Bang the Metal Boy here,"
said Sweet William, a thin edge of panic in his voice.
"But I agree. What are you talking about?"
Sellers raised his arms.
"Jonas knows something. He must. The Brotherhood would have killed him already if he weren't important. Find him. Now go!"
The chorus of questions began again, but Sellers' sim abruptly flared and then disappeared. Fredericks shook his head miserably.
"This is horrible. Like some kind of story where everything ends wrong."
"We have to get going." Orlando grabbed his friend's arm.
"Come on. What choice do we have?"
He saw that Nefertiti and the monkey were helping their friend to her feet.
"We're going with them."
He stood, taking a moment to be sure he had his balance. The fever had receded a little. He felt weak, but more clear-headed.
"We're going to the ship."
"Just like Sellers said." Orlando made his voice louder.
"The rest of you can do what you want, but I wouldn't stay here until they managed to trace me. So if you're coming, follow me."
Sweet William swept his cloak back over his shoulder.
"Aye, sunshine, who died and made you, Mr. Happy?"
The monkey had climbed back onto the table.
"The time for arguing is over," it said. "This man is right. Go or stay."
"We can't just go charging out of here."
Nefertiti was frowning.
"If we do that, someone will come in to investigate."
"Investigate?"
The woman on the other side of the table had a slightly hysterical sound.
"They're already investigating. He just said so."
"I'm talking about here,"
said Nefertiti. "Outside, in the real world, the Brotherhood or whoever has shot Atasco down. But in here, the people of Temelune don't know they're not real, and they don't care a bit about what's happening in RL. They think we're here having a meeting with their king or whatever. If we go thundering out like something's wrong, we'll never make it to the docks." Orlando nodded slowly, revising his earlier high estimation upward.
"Hide the body," he said.
"Both the bodies." It took more than a few minutes, since within the simulation, the deserted sims had the weight and heft of corpses. Corpses in advanced rigor mortis, as Orlando noticed while helping to trundle the unwieldy, seated form of Mrs. Atasco, which made their task even more difficult. What little strength he had was waning quickly in the struggle with the bodies, and he had no idea of how far they would have to travel. He surrendered to Fredericks his position as impromptu pallbearer and joined the search for a hiding place instead. The baboon discovered a small anteroom hidden behind a screen, and the rest gratefully bundled the Atasco sims into it. Despite Sweet William's obvious discontent, the party then fell into line behind Orlando and Nefertiti.
"Now act calm,"
the tall woman said as she reached for the door. The guards stepped back as the guests filed out. Orlando saw with approval that Fredericks, though unhappy, was maintaining a stiff but impenetrable expression. Some of the others, however, were not hiding their anxiety quite so well, and the sharp-eyed proximity of the guards was not helping matters. Someone behind Orlando was trying to choke back a sob. The guards heard it too, judging by the way their heads were swiveling to find the source of the noise. Orlando stepped toward what he guessed was the captain, the guard with the highest helmet and longest and most brilliant feathered cape. He searched his game-playing lexicon for words that sounded properly melodramatic. "Our requests were refused," he said. "The Great and Holy One, in his wisdom, has told us the time is not yet correct." He hoped he sounded both disappointed and yet honored even to have been granted an audience. "Blessed is he!" The guard captain cocked an eyebrow. Sweet William stepped forward, all tassels and points, and the captain's other eyebrow went up as well, while Orlando's heart traveled in the opposite direction.
"Yes, blessed is he," said the apparition in black, with a fairly convincing stab at humility. "In fact, our poor embassy has angered him, and while he has kindly restrained his wrath so that we may return to our country and tell our masters the God-King's will, his displeasure with our masters is great. He commands that he will not be disturbed until sunset."
Mentally, Orlando put a check beside Sweet William's name. The guy was quick and smooth when he wanted to be. You had to give him that. The captain did not seem entirely convinced. He fingered the stone blade of an axe that, despite evidence of more modern technologies all around, did not look at all ceremonial. "But it is already sunset."
"Ah,"
said Sweet William, momentarily nonplussed.
"Sunset?"
Orlando jumped in. "Our command of your tongue is very poor. Doubtless the God-King meant sunrise. In any case, he did not wish to be disturbed." Orlando leaned closer, in best conspiratorial fashion. A word to the wise. He was very, very unhappy. I would not want to be the man who interrupted his thoughts and made him even more unhappy. The captain nodded slightly, still frowning. Orlando rejoined the line at the back, just behind Sweet William.
"Not bad, Chuck,"
William stage whispered over his shoulder when they were out of earshot.
"We could be a team. End of the pier. Leave 'em laughing. You sing?"
"Keep walking," said Orlando. When they reached the rotunda just inside the front doors, Orlando hurried forward. The tall woman was clearly chafing at the slow pace of her disabled friend, but was doing her best to maintain an air of deliberate dignity.
"Do you know where we're going from here?"
Orlando asked in a whisper.
"Not a clue."
She looked at him briefly.
"What is your name? You said, but I've forgotten."
"Orlando. What's yours?" She hesitated, then said,
"Oh, God, what difference does it make now? Rini."
Orlando nodded. "I've been calling you Nefertiti. Rini is easier." She gave him a strange look, then, after a moment, looked down at her long-fingered hand.
"Ah, the Sim. Right."
She glanced up. The huge doors loomed.
"Now what? Do we just mill around in front trying to figure out where the docks are? But even if we find out, how do we get there? I know they have buses. I rode on one. But somehow it seems like a strange idea trying to escape for your life by bus."
Orlando pushed at the doors, but could not get them open. Fredericks added his weight, and they swung wide, revealing a mall lined with street lamps stretching out from the bottom of the wide staircase. Orlando was already feeling a little short of breath. "Escaping by bus won't be the strangest thing that's happened to us so far," he said.
"And it probably won't be the worst, either,"
noted Fredericks. Félix Jongleur, these days more frequently known as Osiris, Lord of Life and Death, was trying to decide where he was. This was not the confusion of someone stupefied or geographically confused, but rather a fairly difficult philosophical proposition. In fact, it was a question with which he often wrestled in idle moments. What he saw all around him was the stark grandeur of the Western Palace, its looming windows filled with eternal twilight. Flanking the table before him stretched the double line of animal faces that represented his collaborators, the Ennead. But even as he took a deep, contemplative breath in the Western Palace, his actual flesh and blood lungs were doing their work in a sealed hyperbaric chamber within the highest tower of his secluded Louisiana estate, along with the rest of his body. The lungs were aided in their labors by some of the finest medical equipment that money could buy. for the god's lungs were very, very old. But that was the crux of an entirely different metaphysical inquiry. So, as always, the question remained this. Where was he, Félix Jongleur, that which observed? The hot white point at the center of the candle flame. To the extent that his actual body was located in the real world, he was in the southernmost part of the United States. But his mind lived almost entirely in virtual worlds, mostly within his favorite, an imaginary Egypt, complete with a pantheon of gods over which he reigned. So where was he truly? On the shores of Louisiana's Lake Bourne? In a gothic fantasy castle built on reclaimed swampland? On an electronic network? In an even more fantastic castle in Egypt's mythical west? Or in some other place more difficult to name or locate? Jongleur stifled a small sigh. On this day, such maundering was a sign of nearly unforgivable weakness. He was a little anxious, although that was scarcely surprising. What happened in this gathering would affect not only his own life's ambition, but quite possibly the very history of humankind. The Grail Project, when completed, would have almost unbelievable ramifications, so it was critical he retain control. His own determined vision had prevailed for so long that the project might well fail without him. He wondered if some of the resistance to his long rule over the Brotherhood might be nothing more than the craving for novelty. For all their wealth and immense personal power, the Ennead had proven themselves to possess many other quite human frailties, and it was difficult to retain patience for a project that had stretched over so many years. Perhaps he hadn't given them enough showmanship lately. He was distracted by a movement down the table. A grotesque form, with the shining head of a beetle, rose and coughed politely.
If we may begin?
Jongleur was again Osiris. The Lord of Life and Death inclined his head.
First of all, the beetle man said, it is a pleasure to be in your company once more, to be among equals.
The round brown head turned to make a careful survey. The god could barely refrain from laughing out loud at the attempts at political dignity, seriously undercut by goggling opaque eyes and quivering mandibles. Osiris had chosen Ricardo Clement's god persona well. The beetle Kepera was an aspect of the solar deity, but for all that he was still a dung beetle, a creature that spent its life rolling little balls of shit, which described the Argentinian perfectly.
We have much to discuss today, so I will not take up time with unnecessary talk.
Clement bobbed like a shopkeeping insect out of a children's book, a particularly apt simile, since his immense fortune had come out of black market organ farming.
Then don't.
Sekhmet shot her claws and daintily scratched her chin.
What is your business?
If the beetle had possessed recognizable facial features, the look he gave her might have been more effective.
I would like to ask the chairman for a progress report on the Sky God Project.
Osiris swallowed another chuckle. The Argentinian had made a complete nuisance of himself about Sky God on the grounds that it was in his own territory, offering bad advice and useless personal recommendations. Osiris had made a deliberate effort to seem grateful for all this help, though. A vote was a vote, after all.
Thanks in large part to you, Ricardo. Things are going very well indeed. I expect to have an update before the meeting is over, so if you will allow me to postpone any deeper discussion until then?
Of course, Chairman.
The beetle man bowed and settled back into his chair. Osiris watched Ptah and Horus, who were very still. He suspected that the Americans were engaged in a little sidebar communication, and wondered what exactly had made them so eager to push forward the date of this month's meeting. The normal business went swiftly. A consortium to be organized, the better to bypass certain UN restrictions on the transshipment of precious metals. A newly privatized power grid in West Africa to be bought at an advantageous price. A few witnesses in an Indian court case to be bribed or removed. Osiris was beginning to think he might have overestimated his American rivals. He expected good results from Colombia at any time, and was considering how best to orchestrate the announcement when yellow-faced Ptah abruptly stood.
Before we finish, Chairman, there is one thing more.
The god stiffened for a practically imperceptible moment.
Yes?
Last meeting, We had some conversation about the lost subject, if you recall. The one who somehow disappeared within the Grail system. Some information has developed in-house at TMX, so we thought it would be a good time for you to tell us how your own investigation of the incident is going.
His smile was tight-lipped, but wide.
That way, the Brotherhood will be updated, and we can share necessary information.
So, the wire was now visible, which meant that Wells and Yacoubian must think that the snare was unavoidable. Osiris let his mind run quickly through the latest developments, which were few. What was their angle?
"I have agents operating within the system, as you know," he said. "They have made a few incomplete identifications, none of which, unfortunately, has been good enough to trigger a retrieval. It's likely that they were just spikes of statistical similarity."
He turned to focus his remarks on Thoth, Sekhmet, and the rest of the Asian contingent. Osiris knew that the Asians liked personal guarantees.
"Still, I have every confidence, we will have results before too long."
He turned back to Ptah, spreading his hands like a father teasing his young and overeager sons.
"Now, what have you to add to this?"
"During a TMX security check, about a totally unrelated matter, as it happens, we ran into some anomalies in the access records for the Grail Project. To put it simply, there has been improper access."
Ta said it gravely, and was rewarded by appropriate noises of concern from around the table.
"Please note I said improper rather than unauthorized. Yes, of course, you're all shocked. You should be. Our chairman will agree that the energy and resources put into protecting the integrity of the Grail Project, not to mention its secrecy, have been immense and, we thought, unbeatable."
Osiris remained silent. He did not like the direction this was going. For Wells to admit a security breach in his own operation in front of the assembled elite of the Brotherhood meant he thought he had something he could turn to his advantage. Otherwise, he would simply have buried it. The escaped subject mattered little to anyone but Osiris.
"This is very bad."
Sobek's crocodile head thrust forward.
"Very bad. How could this happen?"
"There is only one way to get access to the system,"
explained Ptah.
"And that is with command permission from myself or the chairman."
He sketched a gently mocking bow toward Osiris. End of Side 23. To continue, turn the cassette over. Side 24. City of Golden Shadow. Otherland, Volume 1. By Tad Williams. Continuing on page 745.
"Even those employees of mine, or the chairman's, who work with the project every day, must still receive permission before they begin their shift, and again if they come back after logging off for a break. This permission is in the form of a perpetually changing code key, generated by sealed black box code generators. There are only two. I have one. The chairman has the other."
Sobek was nodding his long head up and down. The ruler of a West African nation, which he and his family had wrung dry of gold and blood for decades, he understood the concept of centralization of authority very well.
"Get to the point. What does this have to do with someone interfering with our project?"
"Just as access to the system is carefully limited, so any adjustment to the system must also come with code authorization from one of the two of us."
Ptah was speaking carefully for the benefit of those like Sobek, whose place in the Brotherhood had less to do with technical expertise than with available resources.
"If the escape of the subject was not a freak accident, then it had to have been directed. If directed, the action itself would have needed approval. The system will allow no outside modification that does not come with approval."
Osiris was still mystified. but he could feel Pta moving closer to what he seemed to think was some kind of mortal blow.
"I think we all have the gist now," he said out loud. "Perhaps you could move from the general to the specific. What exactly have you discovered?"
Horace now stood, golden eyes glinting.
"We discovered anomalies. That's what we discovered. Actions taken by two different TMX employees in the week before the subject, or whatever you want to call him, escaped."
The American general had all the subtlety of a cattle stampede. Osiris decided that Wells must feel fairly confident if he was going to let his crony handle part of the attack, especially if Wells' own employees were somehow to blame.
"Although we can't figure out yet exactly how these two helped to drop the subject off our radar and lose him in the system, we're pretty damn confident that that's what happened. There is no other explanation for the actions they took, no other discernible results, and we can't find any reason for them to have taken those actions either. Well, that's not strictly true. Actually, there was quite a good reason for them to do what they did."
The Lord of Life and Death was not going to let any upstart garner the benefit of dramatic pauses.
"We are all fascinated, I assure you. Go on."
"They were both acting under coded orders from the chairman."
Horace turned from the table at large to focus on Osiris.
"From you."
Osiris remained absolutely still. Blustering would do nothing to silence the whispers or still the doubts.
"What are you suggesting?"
"You tell us, Chairman."
This was Ptah, with more than a hint of satisfaction.
"You tell us how a subject that you wanted in the system in the first place, although you didn't bother to share your reasons with us, was cut free and released from surveillance by coded orders that only you can generate."
"Yeah,"
said Horace, unable to resist grinding the point home.
"Let us know, would you? An awful lot of people have invested an awful lot of money in this project. They might want to know if you've decided to make it your personal playground."
Osiris could feel the shock at the table, the rising anger and unhappiness, much of it directed at himself. Even Thoth, usually placid to the point of near invisibility, was shifting in his chair.
"Am I to understand you are accusing me of this? Of engineering the escape of this subject? And you expect me to react to this dangerous nonsense with no evidence for it but your own words?"
"Let's not be hasty,"
said Ptah silkily. Osiris thought he might already be regretting the slack in Yakubian's leash.
"We have not formally accused you of anything, but we freely make our investigation records available to the Brotherhood, and they do raise some grave questions."
He gestured, and a small glowing dot appeared before each of the participants, indicating the available files.
"I think the burden of proof is on you, Chairman, at least to explain how your code wound up on orders that have no other visible purpose than to facilitate the subject's escape."
Underneath the permanent half-smile of his mask, Osiris employed the long pause to quickly range through the reports Wells had just made available. The details were uncomfortable.
"There is more here than simply concern over this subject," he said at last.
He would have a far better chance if he could inject a note of the personal into things. The Americans were not terribly popular.
"Am I wrong in thinking that you feel my leadership is somehow lacking?"
He turned to the table at large.
"Surely you have all seen our comrades' impatience with my direction. Ptah the Artificer was the cleverest of Egypt's gods, and our own version is equally clever. Certainly he must often feel that he could do a better job, that if he could only dislodge me, he and bold Horus could bring a certain vigor to the Brotherhood's leadership."
He let his voice drop a bitter degree.
"He is a fool, of course."
"Please, Chairman."
Wells sounded amused.
"This is rhetoric. We need answers."
"I am never in as much of a hurry as you are."
Osiris assumed his calmest tones.
"However, Sometimes I arrive at the same positions as you do, even if my pace brings me there more slowly. This is one of those times.
What are you talking about?
Now Ptah was the one to sound off balance. Simply this. If what you say is correct, then I do not deserve the confidence of the Brotherhood. We agree on that. Neither can the project go forward without solidarity among us. So I propose that we examine the matter as fully as we can, examining all the evidence, and then put the matter to a vote, today. If the Brotherhood votes against me, I will step down immediately. Agreed?
Horace nodded briskly. Sounds fair?
Ptah also agreed, but a little more slowly, sniffing for a trap. Osiris had no trap to set. He was still rather dumbfounded by the revelations of the last few minutes, but he had decided a long time ago that it was better to die with your teeth in your enemy's throat than to slink away. As yet, he had never had to do either.
First, he said, while your report seems admirably thorough, I'm sure that the Brotherhood would like to hear from the two employees in person.
He received nods from his other guests, which he accepted with a courtly inclination of his own masked head.
You have detained them, of course.
Of course.
Ptah was confident now. A bad sign. Osiris had half hoped that TMX's earlier in-house interrogations had been too vigorous. It was hard to convict on the evidence of dead witnesses, even with hologrammatic records. Data could be so easily manipulated these days. Not that real-time VR was immune from manipulation, but the process was much more difficult.
Well, bring them in, will you? Isolated from each other, of course. And since you have brought what is tantamount to an accusation against me, you will permit me to do the interrogation, will you not?
Of course,
Ptah agreed, but now it was his falcon-headed crony who did not seem pleased. Osiris took some small pleasure from this sign that at some level they still feared him, worried about his legendary craftiness. He would do his best to justify that unease. The Lord of Life and Death waved his hand, and the table vanished. The Ennead were now seated in a circle, each in his or her own throne-like chair. A moment later, two figures blinked into existence at the circle's center, one stocky and one slender, both immobile as statues. They appeared quite human, and thus seemed strangely out of place amid the avid beast faces. As befitted mortals in the land of the gods, they were only half the size of the smallest of the Ennead.
"My employees, Shoemaker and Miller,"
said Ptah.
"You have all their personal details in our submission."
Osiris leaned forward and extended a mummy-wrapped finger. The older-looking of the two, bearded and strongly built, twitched as though awakening from slumber.
"David Shoemaker," the god intoned, "your only hope is to answer all questions with complete honesty. Is that understood?"
The man's eyes widened. He had undoubtedly gone directly from his last interrogation to the blackness of enforced sleep. Waking up to this, Osiris thought, must be disorienting, to say the least.
"I said, is that understood?"
Where am I? The lord of the two lands gestured. The man writhed, his eyes squeezed shut and his teeth bared in a rictus of agony. After the brief burst of induced pain ended, Osiris watched the convulsive bunching of the man's muscles, knowing that the other members of the Brotherhood were also watching. It never hurt to remind them what he could do. He was a god here, with powers that the others did not possess, not even in their own domains. It never hurt to remind them.
"I will try again. Your only hope is to answer all questions with complete honesty. Do you understand?"
The bearded man nodded. His sim, generated by the holocell in which he was restrained, was already white-faced with dread.
"Good. Please also understand that what I can do to you is not like normal pain. It will not damage your body. You will not die from it.
That means I can subject you to it for as long as I like. He paused to let this sink in. Now, you will tell us everything about the events that led up to your interfering in the normal workings of the Grail system. Through the course of the next hour, Osiris led Shoemaker through a minute examination of his and Glenn Miller's work as systems engineers on the Otherland network. Slow answers, even hesitations while the prisoner tried to remember some small detail, were met with immediate activation of the pain reflex, which Osiris often held like an orchestral note, judging what duration should most promote quick and honest responses. Despite the continual razor slashes of agony, Shoemaker stuck to the story he had already told TMX security. He had received what seemed a legitimate order to modify the tracking elements that sent back data on the subject's whereabouts within the system, but had no way of knowing that the changes would eventually make tracking impossible. The order had appeared to come through legitimate management channels, although TMX security had proved afterward that the management approvals were fairly obvious forgeries, and, most critically, had contained the chairman's own inimitable authorization. The chairman, the living master of the two lands, was not pleased to hear himself indicted again. Of course, if you were a spy within the system, you might say the very same thing. And if you had a high enough pain threshold, you might continue to say it no matter what kind of messages I pump into your central nervous system. He frowned at the panting, shivering simulation. You might even have received some kind of post-hypnotic block or neural modification. He turned to Ptah. I suppose you scanned both of these men? The yellow face smiled.
It's in the records. No detectable mods.
Osiris gestured again. An array of glittering metallic arms sprouted from the floor, spread-eagling the prisoner. Perhaps a more subtle approach is called for. Another gesture brought forth more jointed arms, each of these veined in transparent tubing and barbed at the end with a huge needle. I understand from your employee profile that you have an aversion to medical procedure and pharmaceuticals. Some bad experience in your childhood, perhaps? He pointed. One by one, the arms tilted down like the jaws of some strange, venomous insect, the needles plunging into different soft parts of the prisoner's body. Perhaps this will help you to rethink your story, which I find woefully inadequate. The prisoner, who had been struggling to find his voice, found it, as different colored liquids began to pulse through the tubing, oozing inexorably toward him. He let loose a bone-rattling scream. As black and green stains blossomed around the needle entries and began to spread out beneath his skin, Shoemaker's ear-piercing shriek jumped to a newer, higher level of madness. Osiris shook his head. He dulled the man's ragged cries to a faint piping, then flicked the second prisoner into life. "I'm not going to tell you where you are, so don't bother to ask." The god was beginning to feel quite cross. You are going to tell me things instead. Do you see your friend? The second man, whose thick black hair and high cheekbones suggested an Asian heritage, nodded, eyes wide with anticipatory terror. Well, Miller, the two of you have been very naughty fellows indeed. You have interfered with the proper functioning of the Grail Project, and worst of all, you have done so without authorization.
But we were authorized! Miller shouted. Oh, Christ, why won't anyone believe us?
Because it is easy to lie. Osiris spread his fingers, and Miller was suddenly surrounded by a glassy cube 3 times his height. Several of the Ennead leaned forward, spectators at an evening's entertainment. But it is not easy to lie when you are fighting to maintain your very sanity. Your records indicate that you have a morbid fear of drowning. So, while you think about who put you up to this little prank, I will give you a chance to explore that fear at first hand. The cube began to fill with water,
The prisoner, who must have known that his physical body was still in restraint somewhere in the telemorphic's offices, while only his mind was being tortured, but could not enjoy the distinction, began to pound on the transparent walls. "We can hear you. Tell us what you know. Look, the water is already at your knees." As the brackish water rose to his waist, his chest, his neck, Miller babbled shrilly about the order he had received to turn on the thalamic splitter for what he had thought was some kind of testing. He had never imagined for a moment that the splitter was still enchained, and that his action would complete the subject's release. Even as he was forced to leap to keep his mouth above water, he swore that he knew nothing beyond what he had been directed to do. The cube was filling faster. The prisoner swam in rapid dog-paddle style, but each moment brought him closer to the roof of the cube and diminished the pocket of air. Osiris suppressed a sigh. This Miller's terror was so palpable, it almost made him uncomfortable. But the man showed no sign of changing his story. More importantly, the Lord of Life and Death was rapidly losing the confidence of the assembled Brotherhood. The cube was now completely filled. The prisoner's desperate thrashings, which had reached their peak, suddenly stopped as Miller took a great gulp of the greenish water, trying to hasten the end. A moment later he took another. The look of frenzied panic on his face abruptly grew even more acute. "No, you won't die. Your lungs will burn. You will choke. You will struggle. But you will not die. You will continue to drown as long as I wish it." Osiris could not keep the frustration out of his voice. He looked to the other prisoner, a swollen lump of blackened, pustulant flesh, now barely recognizable as human, still spiked beneath a dozen needles, still screaming through a ragged spiracle that had once been a mouth. This was all sideshow now. These men knew nothing. Sensing victory, Ptah stood.
"If the chairman has no further questions for these two unfortunates, perhaps he would like the chance to offer an explanation to the rest of the Brotherhood?"
In a moment, he pretended an interest in the maddened struggles of the two TMX employees, while quickly reviewing the report Wells and Yacoubian had submitted. His expert systems had been combing the material for anomalies, and had compiled a short list of things that needed clarification. As the superimposed information flickered across his vision, a heaviness settled on him. The expert systems had turned up nothing but noise, discrepancies in testimony that indicated little but human sloppiness and imprecision. Everything else fitted Wells' interpretation. Within moments, control of the Brotherhood and over the Grail Project would slip from the chief god's hands. In its cocoon of metal and expensive liquids, Félix Jongleur's real body stirred. His heart seemed to labor. Osiris, the immortal god, suddenly felt his age. His colleagues were murmuring, their patience exhausted. He scanned the report again listlessly, trying to think of something that could be done to save the situation. Adamant denial? Worthless. Delay? He himself had demanded speed, hoping to catch Wells and Yacoubian unprepared for a real showdown. He could not renege on that demand without ensuring a loss of control. Could he hold the project itself hostage? The others might have difficulty finishing it without his expertise, and most importantly, his control over the other. But an aborted Grail project did him no good, and without the resources of the Brotherhood, he could never duplicate the work that had gone into it. Not in time. Desperately, he called back up the actual authorizations, hoping against logic to spot something his expert systems had not. The embedded dates were correct. The authorizations for work were real, and the authorization code had clearly been generated from his own machines.
"Chairman, we are waiting."
Ptah was in a good humor. Comparatively speaking, he had all the time in the world.
"Just a moment."
Osiris stared at the data before him, realizing absently that none of the Brotherhood could tell what he was doing, that they would only see him sitting motionless. Did they wonder if he were having some kind of breakdown? He called for some other records and compared them with the fire-bright numbers before him. Somewhere, it might have been another universe, his heart began to beat faster, like an ancient beast awakening from slumber. Even the best expert systems could make assumptions. Osiris began to laugh. Chairman? It was too perfect. He paused for a silent moment of exultation. I would like to direct the Brotherhood's attention to the code sequences in question. He waved his hand. Line after line of numbers appeared on the council chamber's nearest roof column, carved into the very stone like the other names of power etched on the walls and doors of the Western Palace. It was appropriate. These strings of numerals were the incantations that would preserve Jongleur's most magnificent and audacious dream. Please check to make sure they are the sequences you have submitted, the sequences that authorized action and allowed the subject's escape. Ptah and Horus exchanged glances. Ibis-headed Thoth answered.
They are the same, Chairman.
Good. As you see in the report, embedded between the larger random sections are other non-random sequences. These sequences indicate the kind of order it is, the date and time, the person who authorized it, and so on.
But we've already established that this code came from your own generator. You admitted it.
Horus could not restrain his impatient anger. If his funeral mask had permitted it, he would have grinned at him. But you do not know all the sequences and what they import. You see, this is an authorization for action, and it did come from me, but it did not go to either of those creatures. He indicated the perpetually drowning man and the puddle of twitching slime, then turned back to Horus. It went to you, Daniel.
What the hell are you talking about?
All the orders generated from me carry a short sequence that indicates where they are bound. These were sent to the military arm of the Brotherhood, not to TMX. Someone has penetrated your system, Daniel. They intercepted what were probably fairly unimportant orders, likely something to do with that business in New Reno. The dates would be about right. Modified them slightly, then used the coded authorizations to issue quite different orders of their own to the TMX engineering department.
That's preposterous!
Horus groped in empty air, looking for a cigar on his RL desk. Ptah was a little more cautious.
But we have never known that about your authorizations, Chairman. Isn't that a little convenient?
Osiris laughed again.
Bring up all the records you want. Let us have a really good look at prior authorizations. Then tell me I'm wrong.
Ptah and Horus glanced at each other. At the long table in the Western Palace they were silent, but the Lord of the Two Lands felt quite certain that conversation on the sidebar channel had suddenly become white hot. When they finally took the vote an hour later, it was unanimous. Even Ptah and Horus displayed the good grace, or political savvy, to vote for his retention as chairman. Osiris was well pleased. Both Americans had received heavy blows to their ambition, and would be on the defensive for some time. First, their own systems had apparently been penetrated. Then they had been seen to blame that on their venerable chairman. He particularly enjoyed ordering Horus to shore up his security, and to get to work locating and defining the incursion. And while you're at it, excise those two. He indicated Miller and Shoemaker, neither of whom was now capable of making anything but bubbling noises. I suggest a car accident, a couple of work chums on their way to some dreadful TMX morale-raising picnic. You know the sort of thing. Ptah acceded with stiff grace, passing a message to his security service. The two Sims disappeared, which gave the room a far more pleasant aspect. As Kepera rose to his hind legs and began delivering the first of what promised to be a string of testimonials to the re-elected chairman, establishing to the best of his dung-rolling ability that he had never once doubted, that he had been astonished by the charges, and so on, the god received a signal on a designated outside line. His priestly minion, forced to dispense with honorifics after the first few sing-song phrases, announced that Anubis had an urgent message for him. His absent attention unnoticed by the others, Osiris received his underling's report while the beetle man droned on. His young minion seemed strangely calm, which troubled Osiris slightly. After such a triumph, Dredd should have been at his strutting worst. Had he come across something in Otosko's records which had given him ideas? There was also the issue of the actual adversary, the person who had so cleverly subverted TMX security and freed Paul Jonas. That would have to be the subject of many hours' contemplation all by itself. Still, Osiris had known there was an enemy out there somewhere, and in a way was glad of it. The Americans had certainly proved an insufficient challenge. When Anubis had finished his report and signed off, Osiris raised his gauze-shrouded hand for silence. Kepera stopped, his tribute uncompleted. He stood awkwardly for a moment, then lowered himself back into his chair. "Thank you, my dear friend, for those inspiring words," the god said. "I will never forget them. But now I have an announcement to make. I have just received word that the Sky God project has come to a successful conclusion. Shu has been neutralized, along with his intimate circle, and we have possession of his system. Losses of information were negligible, and cleanup is finished. In short, a complete success." The Western Palace echoed with cheers and congratulations, some of them sincere. "I think today is an auspicious day to declare that we have begun the final phase of the Grail Project." He raised his other hand. The walls of the Western Palace fell away. The Ennead were now seated in the midst of an endless, twilight plain. "In only a matter of weeks, our work will be completed, and the fruits of our long labor available at last. The Grail system is about to become operational. Now we are truly become gods." A red shimmer appeared along the far horizon. Osiris spread his arms as if he had summoned it into being, as in fact he had. There was a dramatic rumble of timpanis, a thundering crescendo of percussion. "Rejoice, brotherhood! Our day has come!" The great disk of the rising sun edged upward into the heavens, bleaching the sky, scattering gold across the plains, and bathing the hungry, upraised animal faces in fire. The docks were only a short distance from the broad front steps of the palace, perhaps less than half a mile, judging by the rigging lights that glimmered between the buildings. Orlando and his new allies did their best to form a coherent group before setting off on foot. "This scans utterly," Orlando fumed. "This is a VR simulation. The most powerful one anyone's ever heard of, and we're going to walk." But any loopholes for instantaneous travel or other useful reality-molding tricks that might be built into the structure of Temelun were lost to Orlando and his new allies.
"If we only had one of the Otoskos with us."
They marched as quickly as they could, just beneath the threshold at which their anxious haste would be obvious. The city was busy at this early evening hour, the streets full of traffic, motorized and pedal-driven, the stone sidewalks crowded with Temeluni citizens on their way home from work. But even in this crush of pseudo-humanity, the band of travelers attracted attention. It wasn't that surprising, Orlando decided. There were few cities, virtual or otherwise, where someone as flamboyantly outrageous as Sweet William would not at least briefly draw the eye. Tall Rini fell in beside him again.
"Do you think Sellers meant that as soon as we get on the water we'll cross over into another simulation? Or are we going to have to sail for days?"
Orlando shook his head. "I can't even guess."
"What's to keep them from catching us on the river?"
Fredericks asked, leaning in at Orlando's shoulder.
"I mean, they're not going to leave that throne room alone forever. And when they go looking..."
He stopped, his eyes widening.
"Fen-Fen! For that matter, what happens if we get killed here?"
"You drop offline," Rini began, then paused. The baboon, loping along beside her on all fours, looked up.
"You are thinking that if we cannot go offline now, there is no guarantee that dying a virtual death will change that?"
he asked.
"Or are you considering something worse?"
She shook her head violently.
"It's just not possible. It can't be. Pain is one thing. That could just be hypnotic suggestion. Even induced comas, I will believe. But I really don't want to believe that something happening to you in VR could kill you."
She stopped again.
"No,"
she said firmly, as if putting something in a drawer and shutting it.
"We'll have time to talk about everything later. None of this is useful now.
They hurried on in silence. Since the tall downtown buildings were now blocking the view of the water, Fredericks ran ahead to scout. Surfing along on the surreality of the moment, Orlando found that he was staring at Rini's baboon friend. "What's your name?" he asked the simulated monkey.
"Habu."
There was a click and then a swallowing sound at the beginning. Orlando couldn't tell whether the first letter was supposed to be a G, an H, or a K.
"And you are Orlando."
The look on his face might have been a baboon smile. Orlando nodded. He was sure the person behind the monkey had an interesting story to tell, but he didn't have the strength to wonder about it very much. Later, as Rini had said, later there would be time to talk. If there is a later. Fredericks was hurrying back toward them.
"It's just around the corner," he said. "The boat's all lit up. What if it's not ready to go, Orlando?"
"It's ready to go," he said curtly. He had no idea, but he was damned if he was going to give these people anything else to worry about.
"I saw it when they were bringing us in."
Fredericks gave him a doubtful look, but kept silent.
Chi-seen, man,"
muttered the robot sim dolefully, fingering his own anodized neck in search of his can.
"They gonna catch us, do some harm. This dire, man, this far dire."
The barge was moored at its own dock, a single bright flower of pomp and colorful decoration amid the brutal functionalism of the working side of the harbor. Looking at the graceful ship, Orlando felt the weakness in his limbs recede a little, the dull pain in his head abate. The barge would take them away where their enemies couldn't find them. There would be time to rest, to recover his strength. Rini was looking back over Orlando's shoulder, her finger wagging in the air as though she were conducting a very small orchestra.
"What are you doing?"
Fredericks asked.
"Counting. There are 9 of us. Is that right? Or were there more when we left the palace?"
Fredericks shook his head.
"I don't know. I didn't think about it."
"We should have."
Rini was clearly angry, but it seemed to be at herself.
"We may have lost people along the way."
"Can't worry about it," Orlando said flatly. "Let's just hope there's someone on board who knows how to make the thing go." As if in answer, a group of figures began gathering at the top of the ramp that led onto the barge from the dockside stairs. As Rini gathered the travelers at the ramp's base, 2 of the figures on the ship detached themselves from the rest and came down the gangway toward them. One looked like a reasonably high muckamuck, his cape thatched in silver fish scales. Orlando wondered for a moment if he were the captain, but decided that no one could spend a life at sea and have such unweathered skin. The other man, a non-com in a small plain cape, who was clearly the Temaluni Navy's equivalent of a bonebreaker, had another of those large and unpleasant stone axes in his belt, and some kind of pearl-handled pistol sheathed on the other hip. Rini held up the ring.
"We have been sent by the God-King. He gave us this, and commanded that you take us where we want to go."
The official leaned forward to inspect the ring, while keeping his hands respectfully at his side.
"It certainly looks like the signet of he who is favored above all others. And who, may I ask, are you?"
"We are a delegation from—"
Rini hesitated.
"The Banana Republic," said Orlando hastily. "Sent to request a boon from he who is favored above all others."
He looked up. At the top of the gangway, the dozen waiting sailors were managing simultaneously to stand at rigid attention and to watch the proceedings with interest.
"Now we are being sent back with a message for our masters."
"The ba—"
The official shook his head as though it were all too much for him.
"Still, it is very strange we have not been warned."
"The God-King, I mean he who is favored above all others, only made the decision a very short while ago,"
Rini began.
"Of course,"
the official bowed.
"I will contact the palace to receive my clearance. Please forgive me. I cannot allow you on board until that has been done. I apologize deeply and abjectly for the inconvenience."
Rini looked helplessly down at Habu, then to Orlando. Orlando shrugged, fighting a great and depressing weariness. He had half known something like this would happen, that he could not wear the Thargor Sim without inheriting certain responsibilities. He leaned a little closer toward the bonebreaker. The pistol was on the man's other hip, out of reach. Regretfully, Orlando curled his fingers around the stone axe and snatched it out of the belt even as he shouldered the startled non-com off the gangplank. "Grab him," he said, shoving the official toward Reaney and the others. The sailors at the top of the gangway, bellowing in surprise, had drawn their own sidearms. Orlando was gambling that they would not shoot for fear of harming this obviously important man. However, he couldn't afford to let them start thinking about alternative methods of capture. "Follow me," he called, already sprinting up the ramp.
"What are you doing?"
Fredericks shouted. Orlando didn't answer. If there was anything he knew about, it was virtual combat, and his own personal lesson one was avoid unnecessary chit-chat. Now he just had to pray that some of the Thargor Sim's designated strength and speed remained, despite his own illness and the strictures of an unfamiliar system.
"Help him!" Fredericks was shouting down below. "They'll kill him!"
Orlando leaped from the top end of the gangway and hit the deck rolling, upending the first two sailors. He brought the axe around in a swift arc and felt the sickening give of blade on bone as he shattered another sailor's kneecap. But he could already feel stickiness in his own usually fluid reflexes. The three bodies writhing on the deck around him gave him a moment's desperately needed cover. What little strength he had, and it was less than he was used to in this sim, was draining fast. Already his breath was stinging in his lungs. As he got to his knees, someone jumped onto his back, bearing him down so hard that his forehead cracked against the deck. For a moment, he felt his limbs go uncontrollably limp, but he forced himself to pull his legs under him once more and rise to a crouch. The man on his back was trying to snake an arm around his neck. As Orlando fought to hold him off, a hand with a gun in it swung down close to his face. Orlando smashed at it with the axe and was rewarded with a howl of pain. The gun skittered away, under the railing and into the water. He ducked his head, throwing the man on his back to the deck, then grabbed at the belt of the man he'd kneecapped a few moments before and tugged his pistol out of its holster. Shadows were all around him, closing in. The urge to start firing, to clear away these threatening figures, was very powerful. But they were so much more convincingly human than his usual foes that he found himself almost fatally reluctant. He tossed the gun down the ramp.
"Grab it!"
he gasped, hoping one of his companions would see it lying on the dark gangway. He didn't know if he'd been loud enough to be heard. His head was filling with echoes. Several more men seized the chance and grabbed at his legs and arms. Another fell on top of him, jabbing a knee into his back and closing strong fingers on his throat. Struggling, he managed to throw off a few of his attackers, but more crashed down on top of him in their place. He fought wildly to rise, but only managed to turn over, face to the sky, as he sucked desperately for air. The lights in the barge's rigging stretched and wavered as the blackness in his head grew, as though they were stars sending their dying flare into the eternal night of space. "It's funny," he thought. "Stars, lights, none real, all real." Something was hammering on his head, a dull, rhythmic thump that seemed to rattle his whole skull. Each pounding beat sent a splash of blackness through his thoughts, the tidal mark higher each time. He heard someone shouting. The woman. What was her name? It didn't matter. The breath, the life was being pressed out of him, and he was glad to let it go. He had been so tired, so very tired. He thought he heard Fredericks calling him, but he could not answer. That, at least, was a little sad. Fredericks would have loved the lights. Stars. They were stars, weren't they? Would have loved how bravely they burned in the darkness. He would miss Fredericks. He was in a place, a between place, it seemed, a waiting place, maybe. He couldn't really think about the whole thing very well, and it didn't matter just now anyway. He was lying down, he knew that, but he was also standing, looking out across a great canyon. A massive slope of shiny blackness dropped sheerly away below him, its bottom edge invisible in a sea of swirling fog. On the far side of the canyon, dimly visible through the tendrils of rising mist, was the Golden City. But somehow it was not the same city he had seen before. This city's buildings were taller and stranger than anything he could have imagined, and tiny radiant shapes flitted back and forth among the spiraling towers, brilliant specks of light that might have been fireflies, or angels. "It's another dream," he thought, and was startled to hear he had said it aloud. Surely he should not speak here. Someone was listening, he knew. Someone or something who was looking for him. Someone he did not want to meet.
"It's not a dream,"
a voice said in his ear. He looked around, startled. Sitting on a glossy outcrop of the smooth black substance was an insect the size of a small dog. It was made entirely of glittering silver wires, but was somehow completely alive.
"It's me, boss,"
it said.
"I've been trying to reach you for hours. I've got you amplified all the way, and I can barely hear you."
"What's—" It was so hard to think. The cottony fog had somehow got inside his head as well.
"Where—" "Hurry up, boss. Tell me what you want. If anyone comes in and catches me sitting on your chest, they're going to throw me into the recycler."
A thought, small and fluttery as the distant lights, moved through his mind.
"Beezel?" "Tell me. What's going on?"
He fought to remember.
I'm trapped somewhere. I can't get out. I can't get back." "Where, boss?"
He struggled against the waves of numbness, of darkness. The distant city was gone now, and the fog was rising. He was having trouble seeing even the insect, though it sat only an arm's length away.
"The place I was looking for."
He wanted to remember a name, a man's name. Something with an A?
"Otosko,"
he said. The effort was overwhelming. A moment later, the insect had faded. Orlando was left alone with the mist and the mountainside and the growing dark. Chapter 39. Blue Fire. Netfeed Entertainment. Second Thoughts on Second Sight. Visual opening montage from Here It Comes. VO. Celebrity psychic Fozzie Robinette Murphy, host of the popular net shows Second Sight and Here It Comes, has announced that she is retiring because she has foreseen the end of the world. Visual, Murphy climbing into limousine. When asked how this differs from previous apocalypses she has predicted, Murphy was brief and to the point. Visual, Murphy at front gate of Gloucestershire home. Murphy, because this time it's really going to happen. The coastline gliding past, thick jungle greenery and long-rooted trees drinking at the edges of sandbars, was not entirely strange to her. Rini had seen places along the African coast that looked only a little different. What troubled her now, as she watched a flock of flamingos descending to a salt marsh, like an air squadron returning to base, their brilliant pinks dulled by twilight, was the knowledge that none of it was real.
"It's simply too much to accept. It's seductive. That's what it is."
She leaned over the rail. The fresh wind cooled all of her but the parts of her face covered by her V-tank mask. Even this curious numbness, a kind of tactile blind spot, dead to the world she saw all around her, was beginning to recede, as though her brain were beginning to fill in the experiences, just as with a real ocular blind spot. At certain moments, she could swear she did feel wind on her face. It was difficult not to admire the completeness of this dream, the incredible skill and effort that had gone into it. She had to remind herself that Otosko, the man who had caused this wonder to be built, was perhaps the best of Otherland's feudal barons. He, arrogant and self-involved though he was, had at least had the basic humanity not to harm anyone in pursuit of his own satisfaction. The others, she thought of Stephen's beautiful brown legs atrophied, his arms now like slender sticks. She remembered Susan's shattered body. The others who had built this place were monsters. They were ogres living in castles built from the bones of their victims.
"I have a terrible confession, Rini."
"Habu, you startled me."
"I am sorry."
He clambered onto the railing beside her.
"Do you wish to hear my shameful thought?"
She put a hand on his shoulder. Resisting the impulse to pet him, she simply let it lie there in his thick fur.
"Of course. Since I first came to this place, I have, of course, been worried for our safety, and frightened of the larger evil that the cellar's man described. But almost as strong in me all this time, there has been a great joy."
Rini was suddenly unsure where this was going.
"Joy?"
He pivoted on his rear end and stretched a long arm toward the darkening coastline, a curiously un-baboon-like gesture.
"Because I have seen now that I can make my dream real, whatever evil these people have done, or intend to do, and my heart tells me it is a very great evil indeed. They have also caused an amazing thing to be created. With such power, I think I could truly keep my people alive."
Rini nodded slowly.
That's not a shameful thought, but this kind of power, well, people who have something like this aren't going to give it away. They keep it for themselves, just like they always have.
Habu did not reply. As the last daylight vanished, they remained at the railing together, watching the river and the coast become one inseparable shadow beneath the stars. Sweet William appeared to be taking a perverse pleasure in his role.
Just like Johnny Icepick, me.
He waved the gun menacingly at the captain and the God King's naval adjutant, the official who had met them at the gangway. The two cringed.
It's not my normal line, dearies, but I could develop a taste for it.
Weenie wondered which scared the Temeloonies more, the gun or William's death clown appearance. How far are we from the end of the waters you know? She asked the captain. He shook his head. He was a small man, beardless as all the others, but his face was covered with black tattoos, and he wore an impressively large stone lip plug.
Over and over you ask that. There is no end. On the far side of these waters is the land of pale men. If we continue along the coast as we are doing, we will cross the Caribbean.
Meany heard her translation software pause for a split instant before supplying the name.
And come to the Empire of the Mexica. There is no end.
Weenie sighed. If, as Atasco had said, there was a finite edge to the simulation, then the puppets themselves must not know it. Perhaps they simply ceased to be, then reappeared on their return voyage, filled with suitable memories.
Of course, the same thing could be true for me, and how would I ever know?
As difficult as it was to look at the coastline and believe it a purely digital reality, it was even harder to imagine the captain and the king's adjutant as artificial. A coastline, even one filled with exuberant vegetable life, could be created fractally, although this level of sophistication beggared anything she had ever seen. But people? How could even the most sophisticated programming, the most strenuously evolutionary A-life environments, create such diversity, such seeming authenticity? The captain had bad teeth, stained from chewing some leafy herb. He wore what was obviously a favored knick-knack, a fish vertebra on a chain around his thick neck. The adjutant had a port wine birthmark just behind his ear, and smelled of licorice water.
"Are you married?"
she asked the captain. He blinked.
"I was. Retired because she wanted me to. Stayed ashore for 3 years in Quibdó. Couldn't take it, so I re-enlisted. She left me."
Rini shook her head. A sailor's tale, so common as to be almost a cliché, but by the slight bitterness in his voice, like scar tissue around an old wound, he clearly believed it. And every single person in this simulation, in all the unguessable number of simulations that made up this other land, would have his or her own tale. Each one would believe himself to be alive and singular. It was too much to comprehend.
"Do you have any idea how to make this ship work?"
she asked Sweet William.
"Dead simple, really."
He smiled lazily and stretched. Hidden bells jingled.
"It's got a bit of a handle. Push, pull, forward, back. Could do it in me sleep."
"Then we'll put these two and the rest of the crew overboard."
She was startled by the adjutant's violent reaction for a moment, then realized the misunderstanding.
"In the lifeboats, there seemed to be plenty."
"Aye, aye."
William saluted jauntily.
"Whenever you're ready, Admiral."
The bed in He Who Is Favored Above All Others' massive stateroom was of a size commensurate with celestial royalty. Martine and Orlando lay at either edge, where they could be reached by those caring for them, with a dozen-foot expanse of silken sheets between them. Orlando was sleeping, but Rini didn't think it was a healthy sleep. The big man's breath rasped in and out through his gaping mouth, and the muscles in his fingers and face twitched. She laid her palm across his broad forehead, but felt nothing any more unusual than the mere fact of virtual tactility. Habu clambered up onto the bed and touched the man's face, but he seemed to have a different purpose in mind than Rini had, for he left his delicate simian hand there for a long time.
"He looks very sick,"
Rini said.
"He is."
The slender man named Fredericks looked up from his seat by Orlando's side.
"He's real sick."
"What is it? Is it something he caught outside? In RL, I mean? Or is it some effect from coming into the network?"
Fredericks shook his head morosely.
He's got something bad. In real life. It's a disease where you get old too soon. He told me the name, but I forgot.
He rubbed at his eyes. When he spoke again, his voice was faint.
I think right now he's got pneumonia. He said he was dying.
Reenie stared at the sleeping man's almost cartoonish face, the square jaw and long black hair. Even after only a short acquaintance, the thought of his death was painful. She turned away, helpless and miserable. Too many victims. Too many suffering innocents. Not enough strength to save any of them. Joanne Lee, who had been holding Martine's hand, stood up as Reenie walked around the perimeter of the huge bed.
I wish there was something more I could do for your friend. She is a little quieter now. I thought of offering her some water.
She trailed off. There was no need to finish. Martine, like everyone else, must be receiving nourishment and hydration in the real world. If not, nothing the Chinese woman or anyone else could do would help. Reenie sat on the edge of the bed and wrapped her hand around Martine's. The Frenchwoman had not spoken a word all the way to the ship, and after Sweet William had snatched up the gun which Orlando had tossed away and pressed it against the adjutant's head to secure their passage on the barge, Martine had collapsed. Reenie had carried her on board with Chuan Lee's help. It had taken three of the sailors to carry bulky Orlando, but there was nothing else she could think of to do. Whatever was afflicting Martine was even more mysterious than the young man's ailment. "We're going to put the captain and crew into boats and set them free," Reenie said after a while.
"Are there enough of us to run the ship?"
Chuan Lee asked.
"William says it pretty much sails itself, but I suppose we need enough people to keep watch."
Frowning, she thought for a moment.
"What did I say we were, 9?
She turned. Habu was still crouched beside Orlando, his hands splayed on the big man's chest. His patient seemed to be resting a little more easily.
"Well, there's the 6 of us in here. There's William, although he almost counts for 2.
She smiled wearily, for Chuan Lee's benefit as much as her own.
"The robot man, what did he call himself? T-4B or something? And the woman who went up the rigging to keep watch? Yes, 9. Besides, having a full crew would matter more if we had some idea where we were going."
She broke off as she realized that the gentle pressure on her fingers was becoming stronger. Martine's eyes were open, but still unfixed.
"Reenie, I'm here. We're on the ship. We're hoping to be out of this Temeloon simulation soon."
I'm blind, Reenie.
She forced the words out with great effort.
"I know, Martine. We'll do our best to find a way to..."
She was stopped by a very hard squeeze.
"No, you do not understand. I am blind, not just here. I have been blind for a very long time."
"You mean in your real life?"
Martine nodded slowly.
"But I have... There are modifications on my system that allow me to read my way through the net. I see the data in my own way."
She paused. Speaking was obviously difficult.
"In some ways, it has made me better at what I do than if I had sight. Do you understand? But now, everything is very bad."
"Because of the information rate, like you said?"
"Yes. Since I have come here, it is like people screaming in both my ears, like I am being blown in a great wind. I cannot..."
She brought trembling hands up to her face.
"I am going mad. Ah, may the good Lord save me. I am going mad."
Her face contorted, although no tears came to the same eyes. Her shoulders began to shake. Reenie could only hold her as she wept. 2 large lifeboats held the ship's 3 dozen crew fairly comfortably. Reenie stood on the deck, feeling the shudder of the engine beneath her feet, and watched the last sailor drop from the ladder into the boat, black pigtail flying.
"Are you sure you don't want another lifeboat?"
she called down to the captain.
"You'd be less crowded."
He looked up at her, plainly unable to comprehend this kind of soft-hearted piracy.
"It is not far to shore. We will be fine."
He mumbled his lip plug for a moment, contemplating an indiscretion.
"You know, the patrol boats have only remained at a distance to protect the lives of the crew. They will stop you and board you within minutes after we are safe."
"We are not worried."
Weenie tried to sound confident, but of all their company, only Habu seemed truly calm. The small man had found a long piece of twine in the captain's cabin, and was blithely constructing one of his intricate string figures. Rini's intention to release the hostages before the ship reached the simulation's edge had been the subject of long discussion, but she had been adamant. She would not risk taking the Temeluni out of their world. Perhaps the Otherland machinery would not compensate for them in this peculiar circumstance, and they would then cease to exist. It would be no better than mass murder. The captain shrugged and sat down. He signaled to one of his men to start the engine. The boat glided forward and then began to pick up speed, chugging along after the adjutant's boat, which was already only a white dot against the darkness. A beam of light cut through the fog from the far side of the barge, flicking across the undraped mast.
"Well, there they are, Chuck,"
said William. He held up his confiscated pistol and looked at it sadly.
"This won't be much use against the Royal Featherhead Navy, now will it?"
More lights appeared. These fixed like low-slung stars. Several large vessels were coming up fast behind them. One of them blew a long, deep note on a steam whistle, a sound that vibrated in Rini's bones. Khabu had put down his string. "Perhaps we should consider—" He never had a chance to finish his suggestion. Something whistled past them and splashed into the water off the bow. A moment later, a globe of fire bloomed in the deeps, fountaining the coastal waters and releasing a sullen thump as the sound reached the surface.
"They're shooting at us!"
shouted Fredericks from one of the hatchways. Weenie was silently commending him for obviousness under combat conditions when she noticed that the exploding shell had left some kind of unexpected after-effect in the depths before them. The waters sparkled with glittering points of neon blue. Weenie caught her breath. She struggled to remember the name of the robot goggle boy currently in the barge's wheelhouse, but could not.
"Tell what's his name full speed ahead!" she screamed. "I think we're there!"
Another shell arched overhead and slashed into the water, nearer this time. The impact made the barge rock so that Rini and William had to grab at the railing. Slowly, though, she could feel the ship picking up speed. She leaned over, squinting at the dark swells. Surely the sparkling blue light was brighter now. It looked like an entire school of some exotic bioluminescent fishes had surrounded the royal barge. Something exploded directly beneath them. The entire front end of the barge lifted up, as though shoved from beneath by a giant hand. Rini fell to the deck and slid. The barge tipped sideways. Then, like a living creature, it seemed to find its center of balance and dropped back down into a trough between waves. The water rising around them seemed pulsingly alive with blue light. It was alive. It was electrically active, radiant, and throbbingly, brilliantly vital. All the sounds of sea and ship and exploding shells abruptly stopped. In perfect silence and an absolute blue glow, they passed through. Weenie's first thought was that they were caught in the timeless instant of an explosion, stuck in the dreary heart of a quantum event that would never end. The bright light, more white than blue now, dazzled her so that she had to shut her eyes against the pain. When she carefully opened them a moment later, the light was still there, but she realized it was only the brilliance of an ordinary daytime sky. They had left the night behind them in Temeloon. Her second thought was that the last explosion had blown the entire top off the barge. They still bobbed on the water, and the coastline, now revealed in crystal-clear daylight and full of startlingly huge trees as wide and tall as skyscrapers, was very visible, but there was no longer a railing to look over. Weenie realized she was on her knees, clutching at something curving and fibrous and as thick as her arm that stretched where the railing had been. She dragged herself around so she could look back at where the rest of the barge had been, the wheelhouse, the royal apartment. Her companions were lying in the center of something that was large and flat, but otherwise nothing like a barge. Something ribbed and dimpled like a giant piece of modern sculpture, something that curled at the edges and was as stiffly yielding as crocodile hide beneath Rini's hand.
"Khabu," she said, "are you all right?"
"We have all survived."
He still wore his baboon body.
"But we—"
Rini lost the rest of his sentence in a growing drone from somewhere above. She stared at the flat expanse upon which they all lay, at the almost ragged shape of its edges where they curled up from the water, and realized what the thing they were floating on looked like. Not a boat at all, but—
"A leaf?"
The droning was growing louder and louder, making it hard to think. The huge trees on the distant shoreline— It made a sort of sense, then. They were not a trick of distortion and distance. But was the place itself too large? Or were she and her companions? The sound rattled in her ears. Rini looked up to see something the size of a single-engine airplane glide overhead, hover for a moment so that the wind almost knocked her flat, and then speed away again, wings glinting like stained glass in the bright, bright sun. It was a dragonfly. Jeremiah found him going through the cabinets in the kitchen for perhaps the dozenth time, looking for something that both of them knew was not there.
"Mr. Sulaweo?"
Rini's father tugged open another door and began shoving industrial-sized cans and heat-sealed ration packs out of his way, working with ragged intensity. When he had cleared a hole, he reached in until his armpit was pressing into the front of the shelf and groped in the darkness at the back of the cabinet.
"Mr. Sulaweo! Joseph!"
He turned to stare at Jeremiah, his eyes red-rimmed.
"What do you want?"
"I want a little help. I've been sitting at the console for hours. If you'll take a turn, I can make us something to eat."
"Don't want nothing to eat."
Long Joseph turned back to his search. After a moment, he cursed, retracted his arm, then began the same process on the next shelf down.
"You don't have to eat then, but I do. In any case, that's your daughter in that tank, not mine."
A canister of soy meal tipped off the shelf and thumped onto the floor. Long Joseph continued to scrabble in the space at the back of the shelf.
"Don't you tell me about my daughter. I know who's in that tank."
Jeremiah Dacko made a noise of angry frustration and turned to go. He stopped in the doorway.
"I'm not going to sit there forever staring at those screens. I can't. And when I fall asleep, nobody will be checking their heart rates. Nobody will be watching in case the tanks go wrong. God damn!"
A line of plastic sacks slid off the shelf and toppled. One broke, puffing a sulfurous spray of powdered egg across the cement floor.
"God damn this place!"
Long Joseph swept more sacks from the shelf, then muscled a can up over his head and flung it down so hard it bounced before coming to rest against the rear wall. An ooze of syrup trickled from beneath the crumpled lid.
"What the hell kind of place is this?"
he shouted.
"How's someone supposed to live like this? In some goddamn cave in the ground?"
Long Joseph lifted another can as though to throw it, and Jeremiah flinched, but instead he lowered it again, staring at it as though it had just been handed to him by a visitor from outer space.
"Look at this craziness," he said,
holding it out for Jeremiah to examine. Jeremiah did not move.
"Look, it's a corn porridge. They got goddamn mealy pap in 10-gallon cans. Enough porridge to choke an elephant, but they don't got even one beer."
He laughed harshly and dropped the can on the floor. It rolled ponderously against a cabinet door.
"Shit, I want a drink. I am so dry."
Wide-eyed, Jeremiah shook his head.
"There's nothing here."
"I know that, I know. But sometimes a man just have to look."
Long Joseph looked up from the mess on the floor. He seemed on the verge of tears.
"You say you want to sleep, go sleep. Show me what to do with that goddamn machine."
"That's all. Heartbeat and body temperature are really the important things. You can bring them out just by pushing this. It lifts the tank covers. But your daughter said not to do it unless they were really in trouble."
Long Joseph stared at the two cable-draped sarcophagi, both now standing upright.
"I can't take this," he said at last.
"What do you mean?"
There was an edge of irritation in Jeremiah's voice.
"You said you'd watch for me. I am exhausted."
The other man didn't seem to hear him.
"It's just like Stephen. Just like my boy. She right there, but I can't touch her. Can't help her. Can't do anything."
He scowled.
"She right there, but I can't do anything."
Jeremiah stared at him for a moment. His face softened. He put his hand gently on Long Joseph's shoulder.
"Your daughter is trying to help. She's very brave."
Joseph Sulaweo shrugged the hand away, his eyes fixed on the tanks as though he could see through the dense fibramic shells.
"She one damn fool what she is. She think just because she go to the university she know everything. But I tried to tell her these weren't people to mess about with. She wouldn't listen. None of them listen. They never do."
His face suddenly crumpled, and he blinked at tears.
"All the children gone. All the children gone away."
Jeremiah started to reach out again, then pulled back his hand. After a long silence, He turned and made his way to the elevator, leaving the other man alone with the silent tanks and the bright screens. End of City of Golden Shadow, Otherland, Volume 1, by Tad Williams, TadWillIams, read by Eric Sandvold, in the studios of Talking Book Publishers, Incorporated, a supporting organization to the American Foundation for the Blind, for the Library of Congress, February 2002, published by Daw Books, Incorporated, 375 Hudson Street, New York, New York, 10014.